Hi, this is Sarah Kay, founder of Equal Time for Free Thought. You're listening to WBAI New York, your peace and justice radio. Now more than ever, you've got to believe in equal time for free thought.
My name is Barry Seidman, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought, the singular free thought radio broadcast on the East Coast. On this program, we promote and defend the socio-political philosophy called humanism, which is informed by and founded on scientific naturalism, as we examine how such a worldview can facilitate progressive social change. Today, we will begin a very special conversation about what we've called the deepening crisis, Islam and the structure of global power. From 9/11 to the continuing invasion and occupation of Iraq, to the saber-rattling of a possible war against Iran, Americans have been inundated by the so-called war on terror, and at least, as some see it, the war against fundamentalist Islam. On the right, we hear of Islamofascism and are warned that if we don't stifle the great evil of Islamic terrorism, we are heading for another world war. In liberal circles, while the rhetoric is different, we are still told that the U.S. will hunt down terrorists wherever they may be, and that militaristic, even nuclear, measures against the Middle East are very much still on the table. In contrast, the left has recognized that the war on terror is really a pseudo-war against which the U.S. itself helped create, and that our actions in Afghanistan and Iraq, and perhaps soon in Iran, which are making the world less safe from terrorist actions, are about controlling the precious, if deadly, energy resource of oil, and thus controlling the market so as to benefit the rich and powerful. This conversation will be an analysis of these real reasons for the war on terror. We will take a peek into what is happening on the ground in the Middle East, what Arabs and the broader Muslim world really thinks about us, and just how we ought to understand the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. In part one today, Professor of Philosophy at Bergen Community College, Paul Eckstein, will facilitate the conversation with first Gilbert Achecker, Professor of Politics and International Relations at University of Paris and author of Clash of Barbarisms, September 11th and the Making of a New World Disorder. Then, joining the discussion will be Deepa Kumar, professor of media studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey, journalist Larry Pintak in Egypt, whose latest book is Reflections in a Bloodshot Lens, Islam and the War of Ideas, and finally, Fazia Afzal Khan, professor of English at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and author of Shattering the Stereotypes, Muslim Women Speak Out. Professor Afzal Khan will be speaking from Pakistan. And now, Professor Paul Eckstein.
I wanted to begin by calling your attention to a piece that is going to appear in the October 29th issue of The Nation magazine entitled Apocalypse Now. It's a piece written by Stephen Holmes, and he's, in a sense, reviewing the third volume in the Chalmers Johnson trilogy, the first two volumes of which were Blowback and The Sorrows of Empire, and this final volume of which is called Nemesis. And what Johnson is doing in this final volume is he is actually suggesting that we have already entered the last days of the Republic, by which he means the United States as a republic. America's post-World War II imperialism, he predicts, will soon put an end to self-government in the United States. And then he quotes, "I believe that to maintain the empire abroad requires resources and commitments that will inevitably undercut our domestic democracy and in the end produce a military dictatorship or its civilian equivalent. The destruction of the American Republic may even illustrate a profound historical regularity. Over any fairly lengthy period of time, successful imperialism requires that a domestic republic or a domestic democracy change into a domestic tyranny. He even thinks that the American military is now ripe for a Julius Caesar, that is, for a revolutionary military populist with little interest in republican niceties, so long as some some form of emperorship lies at the end of this rocky path. Either of you care to comment on whether you think the crisis has reached the point so that we should actually be concerned about whatever democratic future the United States still has left?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that I hope he's wrong in this kind of assessment, as you just summarized. It sounds to me utterly pessimistic, and although I'm not very optimistic myself, but I think this is getting pessimism a bit too far, in the sense that, as one French commentator used to say, the worst is not always certain. So that would be the worst. That is a projection into the future of the worst tendencies of the recent historical period in U.S. history with the Bush administration. And of course, if that type of behavior, if that type of line of conduct were to carry on in the future, then you might get into these kind of frightening scenarios. But I do still hope that the U.S. population won't allow such developments to take place. I mean, we can see already a limited but real setback in the kind of developments that started with the Bush administration. And the failure of the Iraqi operation is such that it acted actually as a powerful antidote for this kind of unbridled imperial ambitions as exemplified by the Bush administration.
Yes, I agree with Gilbert that this is a very pessimistic way of looking at where the United States is headed. And, you know, it is one scenario, but I want to look at what's happened over the last few years. The 2006 elections, for instance, was a mandate against the Iraq war. People came out in larger numbers than usual and voted against the Bush administration's very arrogant posturing on an international stage, and actually, you know, gave the Democrats a victory and so on. So in terms of the population of the U.S., I think overwhelmingly there is a sense that the Iraq war is a disaster and that the U.S. should pull out. But the problem, of course, is that we lack the political will. That is to say, the Democratic Party, the opposition party, unfortunately, even though it has been given, you know, a majority in both houses of Congress, has not come forward with a real withdrawal plan. And all three of the major candidates are talking about how the troops are going to still have to be there in 2013 and so on. That said, I think that, you know, if you look at the work of Howard Zinn, the historian, you see that there have been many points in the history of the United States where it looks like, you know, not just war, but even the conditions of working class people in the U.S., it looks like it could get worse and we could head into barbarism. But people have stood up, they've organized, and they've fought back. And it's there that I, you know, would really like to look for a hope of a better future.
I think it's true, of course, that we all do want a better future. And it would be wonderful if we could see some increasing signs of activity on the part of the U.S. population and also on the part of the Democratic Party. But the fact that you point out correctly, Deepa, that even though the voting went the way it did in 2006, the Democratic Party seems to be, it's not even a matter of having trouble getting its act together, but actually seems to be in some sense complicit with the policies that are being followed, with the exception of, you know, the very left wing of the Democratic Party, doesn't really give much hope for the future. I mean, I wonder, for example, whether or not we should read anything into the significance of the recent Israeli raid on Syria. And I wonder if either of you, again, Gilbert, if you'd like to start, whether you have a take on what that actually was all about. What I see and the sources that I look at suggest increasingly that the evidence is that there was, in fact, some kind of planned nuclear facility involved in Syria, but that it was something that wasn't going to be coming online for years and years and years and years, and the Israelis were just trying to flex their muscles given the debacle they faced in the recent Lebanon war, which you yourself have written so eloquently about.
Well, you know, the situation in Syria is so big that it's difficult to tell what was there, and one should always, be very cautious while using the kind of information that is disseminated, which actually often tries to justify what happened. And what better justification you could have from the Israeli point of view than to say that this has something to do with nukes, you know, as the invasion of Iraq was done with the same kind of pretext. I'm not sure at all that there is anything of the kind. I've also read things about radar facilities that were used both by the Syrian government and its Iranian ally, and that would make enough sense without the story about nuclear issues. I see this this operation basically as a warning to Iran. This is just one further step in the escalation of the pressure against Iran, which is orchestrated by the Bush administration. The possibility of some kind of military action, whether by the United States directly or by Israel with U.S. complicity, is very, very real. And so, yes, I mean, if you want to link that to your first question, we are still having to cope with the Bush administration, which is certainly one of the worst, if not the worst administration, the most reactionary and the most aggressive in U.S. history. More generally speaking, what Deepa has said is quite true, pointing to history. I mean, if one were to look at in the midst of the McCarthy period at the future, it would have appeared absolutely bleak and much more frightening than to whatever outlook one could have right now for the future. So I'm not very much convinced of the very deep pessimistic view, although the issue is not that we will see in the near future any kind of deep reversal in the deep nature of U.S. foreign policy. I think whether the Democrats or the Republicans are committed to the same basic kind of imperial agenda with the ambition of imposing U.S. domination over the whole world and thus enhancing the U.S. privileges at all levels, from the economic to the ecological to every kind of privilege.
Okay, Larry, are you there?
I am indeed.
You know, one of the things that impressed me about your book Through a Bloodshot Lens is this notion that you suggest that appearances are as important as realities in some cases, or in many cases. And you're something of a media specialist with respect to the way in which the media in the Middle East works. And I know that you, in your book, you talk constantly about the fact that people in the United States are always asking questions about, you know, why they hate us over there. And they haven't the foggiest idea concerning the way in which the news that is broadcast in the United States is completely different from the news that is broadcast by stations in the Middle East. You want to talk a little bit about the differences between the two media and this notion that you have that they're actually reflections of, you know, different Weltanschauungs or worldviews. Speak to that theme for a bit, will you?
Sure. Well, certainly we all look at the world through a particular prism. And if you've been brought up in the U.S., you're looking through it, looking at it through a certain prism. If you're brought up in Europe or the Middle East, you're looking at it through another prism. And even if reporters approach a story with the best intention in the world, that I'm trying to cover this in a fair way, I'm trying to be objective, whatever objective may be, I'm trying to present the whole truth, we're still going to report it differently. If I, as an American journalist, and someone as a Pakistani journalist and a Singaporean journalist, approach that same story, we frame it differently. What we think is important is going to be different. What we think is important for our viewers is going to be different. And certainly, Iraq is the epitome of this. As the roll-up to the Iraq war took place, you know, we all know about the jingoism in the American media, but certainly in the way that story was framed. And let me give you one specific example. The Saddam Hussein statue on that first day when the U.S. forces are in Baghdad, and Saddam's statue comes down, like the Berlin Wall coming down. Well, the American media reported that as cheering crowds of Iraqis pulled down the statue of Saddam. And to Americans, it was the epitome of the overthrow of the dictator. It was the iconic image from Iraq. Well, here in the Arab world and elsewhere in the Muslim world, it was seen as exactly the opposite. Because not only did they understand it or perceive it differently, but they saw it differently. Because they saw that same shot that Americans saw in a wider framing, and they saw that it was American troops bringing it down. And to them, it said colonization. Two completely different versions of the same story. And in broader strokes, of course, Americans saw the Iraq war as taking down a bad guy, bringing democracy, freeing poor, oppressed people, whereas Arabs saw it as an American dagger in the heart of the Arab world.
Yeah, Fawzia, you also, I've read some of your material, and one of the things that you suggested was, if I'm not mistaken, you were actually in Pakistan at the time of the 9/11 events?
Yes, I was.
And you were actually planning a return trip back to the United States when that. And I remember reading about the fact that that you were shocked at the events, but then you also mentioned in one of your essays that you were impressed by the remarks of Arundhati Roy to the effect that actually the proper question to ask about those events is not, you know, why did they do that to us or why do they hate us so much, but why it took so long. Why should it be a surprise? And I wonder if you would like to sort of comment on that and talk about why it really shouldn't have been a surprise to Americans as an indication of perhaps the sort of different framework issue that Larry was just referring to.
Right. No, I think Larry is right about the fact that we do look at the world differently depending on our situation, you know, where we are located. And I think one of the difficulties that some people, I'm certainly not going to say all Americans because that wouldn't be true, depends on how well-educated you are, how your understanding is shaped, how deep your understanding is of the world and of the U.S.'s role as a hegemonic militaristic power in the world. In this past century, and if you are that person, it doesn't really matter in the long run whether, you know, in the end, rather, that whether you're located in Pakistan or in wherever else or in the U.S., you would be able to see that, in fact, you know, American foreign policy has been really very detrimental to ultimately to the interests of the U.S. citizenry. It's a foreign policy shaped by governments, you know, people in power, and it has always been about sort of exercising a military and economic might of the U.S. on the rest of the world. And Iraq was no different, and what happened in 9/11 was simply the oppressed, and in this case coming from just one part of the world that has been oppressed, and, you know, in this case the Muslim world, sort of hitting back. It was people who do not have power wanting to shake up the big giant, and you have to think about the symbolic sort of significance of the attacks on the World Trade Center, you know, the Senate. People have talked about this endlessly. So, you know, it is a sort of, an attack, a wake-up call, really, however much we abhor the actual action itself and the fact that, you know, so many civilian lives of Americans of all ethnic backgrounds, including many Muslims who were in that background, you know, in that building at the time, how many of those were destroyed, and that was abhorrent. But as Arundhati Roy, and I think that's what I meant when I referred to her comment about, you know, why should it have taken people by surprise, was that every action has a reaction, and I think this was a reaction that was a long time coming. And for most of us who have their ears to the ground and they can see what's going on, it was not that much of a surprise, however horrific, you know, it was, and however much we abhorred the actual action itself.
Deepa, you want to get in on this?
Yes, I agree with Fawzia that I don't think it's necessary for people who live in certain countries to necessarily side with the rulers, the political elite of that country. And certainly we can take an internationalist perspective and side with the oppressed. And by that, I mean not the rulers of various countries in the Middle East or elsewhere, but with the people who actually bear the brunt of U.S. imperialism. But to explore a little bit more, why do they hate us? I mean, look at what the U.S. has done in the Middle East. Fundamentally, U.S. interest in the Middle East is about oil, not so much oil for domestic consumption, but control over oil. This is about the most important resource in the 20th and 21st century, oil, and who controls oil actually has a huge impact on the global economy. So really, whether you're talking about the Truman Doctrine, the Nixon Doctrine, the Carter Doctrine, they're all about how to better secure access to Middle East oil. Now, what has that meant? During the Cold War, that meant the U.S. had a policy of making sure that the this was the Cold War. And so it was a policy of making sure that the left, the secular left, the socialist left, and so on, was kept in its place, because automatically secular nationalism and so on was associated with the Soviet Union. Practically, what did that mean? It meant that in the 50s, when the nationalist Mohammad Mossadegh comes to power in Iran, the CIA overthrows him. Why? Because he had the audacity to actually nationalize the oil and, you know, dare to actually use it in the interests of the people of Iran. And of course, the U.S. would not have any of that. And then similarly, you know, fast forward to the 1990s, the sanctions regime that was imposed on Iraq led to the deaths of 1.5 million people, of which 500,000 were children. And when Madeleine Albright was asked about this, whether the price was worth it, she says, yes, the price is worth it. And then you add to that the bombing and invasion of Afghanistan. You add to that the continued occupation of Iraq. Latest statistics show another million people have died since the U.S. War on Iraq. And then you add to that U.S. funding to the tune of $3 to $5 billion a year for the state of Israel and the completely horrific conditions under which Palestinians live. Anyone is going to be angry with what the United States has done. It's unfortunate that this expression has taken the form of Islamists who use tactics of the kind that unfortunately alienate more people than build support. That's a tragedy. But, you know, in a way, it's a legacy of what the U.S. has done as well, which is use the Islamists as a bulwark against the left. So,
and if I may add to what Deepa is saying, may I?
Yes, go ahead.
Simply to say that, you know, this is, it's the hypocrisy of the United States that I think is one of the really crucial points here that I think the U.S. media consistently misses when it sort of throws its hands up and is aghast at various expressions of anger and so on that come out of the Middle East or the Muslim world in general, talking in sort of rather broad generalizations, because people here in the Muslim world in Pakistan, which is where I'm speaking to you currently, are very, very angry at the United States. You know, there's anger at the hypocrisy. This was the situation when the whole thing with the cartoons broke out. This is the situation right now, for example, with all that's been going on in the U.S. media, with the genocide, you know, the whole stuff about, you know, the discourse around, you know, trying to declare the Armenian genocide. You know, and people are saying, well, what's happening in Iraq? You know, how is that not being called a genocide? You know, you want to go back into the Ottoman history and talk about labeling that a genocide. But, of course, there is genocide continuing right now in Iraq at the hands of the United States government.
Mm-hmm.
There is genocide in Palestine, as Deepa mentioned. You know, I mean, several million Palestinians who have been killed, displaced, several more million who are refugees without a right to return. I mean, the West Bank and Gaza Strip is just one big, huge prison. And for these people, and so that is never up for discussion. That is never up, you know, for critique. But meanwhile, there's all the discourse about, oh, aghast at human rights violations in Iran, aghast at human rights or, you know, violations against women, you know, or this whole stuff around the Danish cartoons. Oh my God, you know, freedom of speech. Well, you know, if you dare to criticize the whole Zionist enterprise, then what happens to freedom of speech there? Clamp down on that immediately.
Yeah.
Those topics are never raised in the United States media. So it's the hypocrisy that really gets people angry and frustrated. And I see that all the time, talking to people who are educated, who are not Islamists
they are
very angry at the United States.
It's a constant theme. I was listening to Michael Ledeen on C-SPAN the other evening, in which he was talking about the violation of women's rights in Iran. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, how come if he wants to talk about the violation of women's rights, he's not standing out there talking about, for example, the conditions in Saudi Arabia? And I know why he's not talking about the conditions in Saudi Arabia and is instead talking about the conditions in Iran. And, you know, I mean, the issue of oil, as Deepa mentioned, I mean, the fact is, even, you know, one of the things that I love about the honesty of the people who really do have a bit of power and authority, real power and authority in the United States, is they don't make any secret of it. I mean, if you look at Alan Greenspan, you know, the recently retired Fed chairman's new book, he comes right out and says that this is really all about oil. And we can see that what's going on is an attempt to remake the strategic situation in the Middle East. And when Condoleezza Rice goes over and says things like that, you know, people in the Middle East say, who does she think she is coming over here and telling us how we're going to, you know, sort of reorganize our part of the world? When you review the historicity of this, what you see, in effect, is that even though the Bush administration may be a particularly radical example of the sort of thing that is going on right now, this is something which is rooted in contemporary American history post-Second World War. We know that there's a history here, but most of the American people don't know it. And that's why, Larry, I was going back to your notion that part of the difficulty is we're dealing with different frameworks. And the fact is, those frameworks are not only real in the sense that there are genuine differences between cultures and cultural dynamics and the rest, but also in the way these events are portrayed in the various medias that interact with those cultures. And
absolutely. And the way that the words and deeds coming out of Washington that are seen as acceptable, understandable, welcomed in the U.S. and assuming they would receive that same reception in the Middle East are seen completely different. A year ago, summer of, where are we, 06, losing track of time, the Lebanon War. Condoleezza Rice talks about the birth pangs of the new Middle East. And at the same time, Arabs are seeing images literally daily of babies dying, of dead babies. When I do presentations and speeches, I have an image of a child just born, just taken out of his mother's womb in a cesarean, because it is riddled with shrapnel. And this kind of an image is running alongside those words, birth pangs of the new Middle East. And so how are people supposed to see those words and hear those words? I think hypocrisy, this word that Fauzia and Deepa, I think, as well talked about, you cannot overstate the impact that American Middle East policy now and, as you say, historically has had in terms of Arabs seeing hypocrisy and the broader Muslim world seeing hypocrisy. I mean, where I sit today in Cairo, now a year and a half ago, democracy in the Arab world was the flavor of the month, right? Suddenly, the Bush administration heard these experts who were saying one of the reasons they hate us is because we support despots and dictators. So suddenly they said, okay, now we want democracy. And of course, the hypocrisy of that kind of a policy resonates out into Pakistan today. But you look at here in Cairo, where suddenly you had a democracy movement, and suddenly it was crushed.
Right.
And right now we have a number of reporters who have either been sent to jail or are awaiting trial because they had the temerity to either criticize the president and his son. One editor has literally been sentenced for criticizing the symbols of the party in the state, Mubarak and his son. And others are awaiting trial. At the same time, human rights groups are being shut down. Okay. Other kinds of NGOs are being shut down. Voices of opposition have gone into self-exile. And a friend of mine who's a top publisher here was just in Washington. He was receiving an award from the National Endowment for Democracy. And he actually was taken in to see Bush in the Oval Office. And he came back so despondent because he said they have abandoned us. No one is talking about democracy in Egypt anymore. The president gave me a tour of the White House, never mentioned politics in Egypt because, of course, Hamas was elected in Gaza,
right,
in the West Bank, and the Muslim Brotherhood got a lot of votes in the last round of elections here.
Right.
Suddenly the White House decided, maybe democracy isn't so good after
not
all.
Such a good
and they've
thing.
Dropped it. And so all of these people, forget the, the people that strapped bombs onto their bodies, but the middle class, the intelligentsia, who want to work for peaceful, civil, political change, feel that they're abandoned by American policy.
And you've been listening to part one of a conversation on the deepening crisis, Islam and the Structure of Global Power, facilitated by Professor Paul Eckstein. Stay tuned next week when we present the conclusion of this conversation, a full hour of Equal Time for Free Thought, beginning at 6 o'clock p.m. Today's show has been engineered by Sean Rhodes and edited by Barry Seidman. Archives of some of our past programs can be found on our website, linked from njhn.org. Thanks to Tim Ridge and the New Jersey Humanist Network for hosting our site. And remember, until next time, tune in, pay it forward, and question everything. Good night.
A downtown window flushed with light. Faces of the dead at five. Drivers as we pass by.